Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War. We pick up the story in early February 1967 with the United States full in the Vietnam War with intensive bombing of North Vietnam by the United States. In February 1967, Newsweek and the New York Times reported that during a trip to Paris, Senator Robert Kennedy of New York had received a peace feeler from Hanoi, North Vietnam, suggesting that the enemy might negotiate if President Johnson stopped the bombing of the North. Sure that Senator Kennedy himself had leaked the news, President Johnson was furious. As Robert Kennedy later told his staff, during a visit to the Oval Office, Johnson started right in by getting mad at me for leaking the story. Kennedy had denied leaking it, and he said he was unsure there had been a peace feeler, but that the leak had probably come from your own State Department. Johnson shouted back, "It's not my State Department, it's your goddamn State Department." By Senator Kennedy's account, the president had told him that within 6 months, the war would end with a military victory and, "I'll destroy you and every one of your dove friends." Kennedy urged Johnson to say that you'll stop the bombing if they'll come to the negotiating table. Johnson replied, "There isn't a chance in hell that I will do that." He shouted at the senator, "You have blood on your hands." Attorney General Katzenbach, who was present, later recalled that he had never seen the president like this, irrational and almost totally out of control. Furious, Kennedy rose to his feet and told Johnson, "I don't have to take that from you. I'm leaving." In March 1967, from the U.S. Senate floor, Senator Kennedy asked the president to stop bombing the North and say he was ready to negotiate with North Vietnam within the week. This provoked more anger from Johnson, as did Martin Luther King Jr.'s announcement that he now opposed the war. That same month, Senator Fulbright of Oregon and other doves argued that by raising the troop level in Vietnam to 414,000, which exceeded the peak U.S. commitment of the Korean War, that Johnson had overstretched his constitutional powers by waging a major conflict without asking Congress for a war declaration. To the White House argument that presidents had often gone to battle on the basis of various forms of approval from Congress beneath the level of a declaration of war, the doves rejoined that with the exception of Korea, these conflicts had been of far more modest scale than the Vietnam War. On the president's behalf, Senator Richard Russell of Georgia replied that the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was almost a declaration of limited war, and that if Johnson wished to, he could legally send 1 million troops to Vietnam. Rebuking the anti-war senator's wish to cap off American involvement at 500,000 troops unless war was declared, the Senate passed a resolution of support by a vote of 72-19 for efforts by the president and other men of goodwill to limit the escalation of the war and negotiate a peace. But the president refused, unless Hanoi stopped its infiltration of South Vietnam. To show his own efforts for peace, the White House released some of his theretofore secret requests of Ho Chi Minh of North Vietnam to bargain, which moved Senator Russell to tell Johnson that Ho Chi Minh just spit in your face. Johnson was certain that Senator Kennedy, who now surpassed him in head-to-head polls of the electorate, was maneuvering to challenge him as an anti-war candidate in 1968. "I think he'd be president tomorrow if he could do it," Johnson told his aide Larry O'Brien in March 1967. "Let's assume that he will try to defeat me for president. I don't honestly believe that if he did that, he could possibly win. I just believe that my state and 20 others would be in revolt. you would be a hell of a lot worse than Teddy Roosevelt and Robert Taft. I don't see that he wants us to have a bad record and to be defeated in 1968, because they'd take all this power that he could get in 1972. Johnson noted that he had never publicly blamed the war on his predecessor, stating, "I tried my best to play fair with Jack Kennedy. I think on Vietnam that he was right where I am, and I'm carrying out his policy." Larry O'Brien reported that Robert Kennedy had assured him that he wanted no goddamn involvement with any peacenik in the country that was trying to use him in any primary. In October 1967, the president complained to Senator Irvin Dirksen of Illinois that Senate foes of the war are being used, and it's hurting our country very, very bad. If we're going to ask these 500,000 men to stay over there, we can't have every senator being a general. It would just be suicide if we stop the bombing, as these idiots are talking about. When you say stop the bombing, you say kill more Americans. That's all it means. He added that General Westmoreland had cabled him that the enemy had lately concentrated more firepower on Americans than in any equivalent period in the history of warfare, much more than is ever poured on Berlin or Tokyo in World War II, and that the only means of protecting Vietnam's demilitarized zone against enemy infiltration was to bomb the North Vietnam's gun positions. He agonized over the danger that if America dropped a bomb in the wrong place, we may wake up in World War III. When his daughter Linda Johnson once returned after a date, her father told her, "Our planes are going into Hanoi and Haiphong tonight. Some old Texas boy will be in the lead bomber and drop one right down a Russian smokestack. And we know what happened to the battleship USS Maine in Cuba, the Lusitania in World War I. So it's time to do some heavy thinking and deep praying." From the start, Johnson had tried to conceal the full, monumental exposure of his war from the public and refused calls to cover it with increased taxes because he thought they would dampen support for the conflict and move people to demand cuts in his beloved Great Society programs. Recalling how war had killed the domestic reforms of Presidents Roosevelt and Truman, he rudely badgered the Federal Reserve Chairman William McChesney Martin to keep interest rates low so that he could have both guns and butter. The president finally agreed with Congress on a temporary surcharge of 10% on personal and corporate income taxes, as well as some spending cuts, but inflation soared. In September 1967, in the Texas city where he had married Lady Bird, Johnson unveiled what he called his San Antonio formula for peace. He would stop all bombing, when this will lead promptly to productive discussions, but only if the enemy would not take advantage of the bombing halt. That October, he asked Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, "How are we ever going to win?" Concluding that his chief was really asking how they could squeeze out a victory in Vietnam before he had to face the voters in November 1968, the defense secretary replied, "I have no idea how we can win it in the next 12 months." To others, the president complained, "It looks as if all the news is bad and the people just do not understand the war." Distraught over the conflict, Johnson surprised some who knew him by turning to religion. Born into the Disciples of Christ, he had once been called a Protestant with a capital P, praying with Billy Graham in his White House bedroom. But Johnson now quietly sought comfort from Catholicism. His daughter Lucy Johnson, who had converted at 18, brought her father to St. Dominic Church in Southwest Washington. She called his Dominican friars "my little monks." After kneeling for 20 minutes, her father would grouse about the absence of knee pads. Lady Bird Johnson much later told me, the author, in 1998, "During that time, I wouldn't have been a bit surprised if Lyndon had decided to become a Catholic." Recalling her own traumas, she went on to relate having traveled by railroad between New York and Washington and realizing, with a physical shudder, that the boxes visible through the windows of a nearby train were actually the coffins of fallen soldiers back from Vietnam. Mrs. Johnson recounted to me, the author, that their first year or two in the White House had been wine and roses, but after that it was pure hell. She saw firsthand how difficult it was for war to be waged without national unity, stating, "God prevent, but if ever again we're in a war, may it begin with something like Pearl Harbor or the Alamo, or else we'll go through that same eroding effect that took place in the Vietnam War." When she mused on wars of the past, she remembered how during a Washington luncheon of 1951, the elderly Edith Bowling Wilson, wife of Woodrow Wilson, still handsome, full-bosomed, feminine, had told her about crossing the Atlantic with Woodrow at the end of World War I for the Paris Peace Conference. On Saturday, October 21, 1967, the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, described by the New York Times newspaper as a coalition of roughly 150 organizations ranging from church groups to the Peking-oriented Progressive Labor Party, led a protest march from the Lincoln Memorial across the Potomac to the Pentagon, which some vowed to shut down. The New York Times reported that organizers were predicting the biggest anti-war rally in the history of the nation. Exceeding expectations, the march attracted about 100,000 people. Hauling an LBJ effigy, one marcher hoisted a placard stating, "The death of King Lyndon." Another sign asked, "Where is Oswald when we need him?" There were concurrent demonstrations against the war in Western Europe, Japan, and Australia. At the White House, the president assured aides who were worried about his physical safety, stating, "They are not going to run me out of town." He was furious to hear that some demonstrators were leaving their draft cards at the Justice Department or burning them. Johnson predicted to his domestic policy aide, Joseph Califano, that communist elements would exploit the protests to create big trouble in the Negro ghetto, and ordered the White House, Capitol, and Pentagon to be guarded by Army soldiers, some incognito in civilian clothes. The day after the march began, Johnson secretly had himself driven with his wife and daughter Linda to the Lincoln Memorial, and then had his driver cross the Potomac and circle the Pentagon. As Marvin Watson later recalled, Johnson was curious about what the hippies looked like, their dress, age, and the flags, bedrolls, blankets, flight bags, and flowers they carried. The president was later scandalized to read an intelligence report that some protesters had urinated in unison and had sex on the Pentagon grounds, and that some female peacenecks had tried to unzip soldiers' trousers, asking, "Wouldn't you rather fuck than fight?" He asked Joseph Califano, his aide, to pass this information to Joseph Alsop, an opinion writer with the Washington Post. Shaken by the size and impact of the Pentagon march, Johnson sought consolation by calling former President Dwight Eisenhower, telling him, "We've just had hell, and these college students. I've had J. Edgar Hoover in after them. Ho Chi Minh sent a bunch of them over a wire in April. He got this friend Dillinger, and he's properly named too, and Stokely Carmichael, and he asked them to come over there. They sat down and planned these demonstrations in Rome and in Bonn and in London and in the United States all on the same day. We arrested 600 of them. We found most of them really were mentally diseased. Hoover has taken 256 that turned in supposedly their draft card, and about 50 of them were college professors who had been examined for the draft by the Army and turned back. So you're dealing with mental problems, kind of like the Oswald deal. We talk too damn much about civil liberties and constitutional rights of the individual and not enough about the rights of the masses. I think your government is in trouble, General. We're in more danger from left-wing influences now than we've ever been in the 37 years since I've been in Washington, D.C. Johnson told Eisenhower, "I wouldn't tell this to any other Republican, but "I've been suffering a terrific onslaught" by Bobby Kennedy. He claimed that the senator had created a group that paid Martin Luther King Jr. to foment urban unrest, and that's caused me a lot of problems in the cities this year. Of King, the president said, "The damn fellow went out to Chicago last week and announced that he was trying to destroy Johnson." The president warned that Bobby thinks he's going to get the nomination in 1968. Eisenhower harumphed, stating, "If ever they want that little pipsqueak as president of the United States, I'm really going to get on the hustings." Johnson warned, "This boy is awfully vicious." Eisenhower agreed, "Absolutely ruthless." Johnson went on, "Old Joe Kennedy was pretty rough, and this boy is rougher than any of them. He's much different from what Jack Kennedy was. Jack was not a vindictive person." "No, he wasn't," said Eisenhower. Referring to Robert Kennedy, whom he disdained as beyond his depth, Eisenhower assured the president, "I think he can take care of him." Johnson replied, "I'm going to do my best." Although he prided himself on his tough exterior, Johnson confessed to Eisenhower on another occasion that he was terrified of Kennedy, stating, "I never know what he's going to do, where he's going to strike." Believing that politics should stop at the water's edge, Eisenhower promised Johnson that although he considered himself a mean Republican, he would not be partisan on the war during the 1968 campaign. Smarting from the Pentagon protest, Johnson explored how to escalate further in Vietnam, asking Russ and McNamara, Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, "Are we now ready to take the wraps off the bombing? I asked the Joint Chiefs of Staff how to shorten the war, but all of their proposals related to outside South Vietnam. We've almost lost the war in the last 2 months in the court of public opinion. The Hawks are throwing in the towel. San Antonio did not get through. If we cannot get negotiations, why don't we hit all the military targets short of provoking Russia and China?" Citing his intelligence findings, Johnson warned congressional leaders that Hanoi would soon push for a significant military victory, probably meaning in the demilitarized zone area, which Ho's generals envisioned as another Dien Bien Phu. Secretary of Defense McNamara cautioned, "The great danger is to lead our people to think we can win the war overnight with bombing. We cannot." Senator Mike Mansfield of Montana replied that, "We could bomb North Vietnam into the Stone Age, but it would not stop the flow of men and material into South Vietnam." Senator Dirksen of Illinois assured the president, "I'm still in your corner. Do not lose this leverage of bombing. Remember how many casualties resulted from the talks during the Korean War." Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat from West Virginia, gave Johnson similar advice about the bombing, stating, "You may lose next year's election because of it, but I believe that history will vindicate you." By now, Senator Defense McNamara felt tortured and disillusioned about the conflict of which he had been a central architect. Over a Halloween lunch at the White House, he told President Johnson it was now impossible to win the war militarily, and that persevering without change in Vietnam would be dangerous, costly in lives, and unsatisfactory to the American people. As McNamara much later recalled, this apostasy raised his tension with Johnson to the breaking point. Johnson soon announced that he would nominate McNamara as president of the World Bank. McNamara later told friends he did not know if I resigned or was fired. Apprised of this later, some of his non-admirers from the Johnson White House staff joked that they would be glad to resolve his confusion. The president now privately deprecated his one-time fair-haired boy by explaining he had feared that McNamara's hand-wringing over Vietnam would make him pull a Forrestal and kill himself. Johnson solicited advice about Vietnam in November from a band of wise men, including General Omar Bradley and Henry Cabot Lodge. With senators deserting his war, Johnson told the elders that he felt like the steering wheel of a car without any control. Dean Acheson, the ex-Secretary of State, said that the cross you have to bear was a lousy Foreign Relations Committee chaired by Senator Fulbright, a dilettante fool. Having made signal mistakes in 1941 and 1950 that had hastened the wars with Japan and Korea, Acheson now gave Johnson a spectacular piece of bad advice during another major war, stating, "I would not talk about negotiations anymore. That isn't the communist method. If they can't win, they just quit after a while." Just before Christmas, during a quick world tour, the president stopped once more at Cam Ranh Bay in South Vietnam, this time for less than 2 hours, telling senior commanders there, "I wish I had things as good a shape at home as you have here." Johnson promised them, "We're not going to yield. We're not going to shimmy." Referring to Lyndon Johnson's new husband, Chuck Robb, he told one Marine, "You know, I'm sending my son-in-law over here in a few weeks." Then reboarding Air Force One, Johnson was off for Vatican City, where he gave Pope Paul VI a bust of himself. In January 1968, Johnson told Congress in his State of the Union that the enemy in Vietnam had been defeated in battle after battle, but he privately warned House and Senate leaders that a full-scale attack on Khe Sanh is imminent. General Westmoreland formed what he called a small secret group to consider the use of tactical nuclear weapons should the highest national authority find it necessary to save U.S. troops at Khe Sanh. This possibility was codenamed Operation Fractured Jaw. When told of this gambit, Johnson was appalled and had Walt Rostow, now his national security advisor, ensure that the Joint Chiefs would present him with no such request. Rejecting Eisenhower's earlier advice, Johnson had decided that use of nuclear weapons should only be considered in the event of a terrible showdown with the Soviet Union. At the end of the month, during the Vietnamese holiday of Tet, came a surprise assault against five of the South's biggest cities, including Saigon, with Viet Cong overrunning the U.S. Embassy and Presidential Palace. "A kamikaze-type thing," Johnson told the congressional leadership. 4 years into this war, he was still asking his advisors why Hanoi soldiers fought with so much more determination than those of the South. Richard Helms of the CIA explained, "There is a certain heroism about dying for the cause." On a Saturday night in February at El Toro Marine Corps Air Station in California, Johnson said goodbye to 1,000 members in combat gear of Camp Pendleton's 27th Regimental Landing Team who were boarding the transports to Vietnam. He later told his aides that a boy from Ohio who had served 4 times in Vietnam told him that he had a little baby boy born yesterday, noting there wasn't a tear in his eye and no bitterness showed in his face. The president confessed, "The encounter really melted me and brought me to my knees." Johnson knew that if he wanted the 1968 Democratic nomination, he would have to fight for it. In November, Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota had decided to challenge the president after Robert Kennedy had turned down anti-war leaders. McCarthy was outraged not only by Johnson's escalation in Vietnam, but why he considered to be the president's grandiose conception of his constitutional power to make war. The Minnesotan had bristled in August 1967 when Attorney General Katzenbach, by then the Undersecretary of State, told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that declaring war had become an outmoded expression. As for Kennedy, the head of the nation's most famous political dynasty did not want to spoil his future chances with a quixotic campaign in 1968, but he remained deeply troubled about the war and Johnson's emotional stability. In the New Hampshire Democratic primary on March 12th, the little-known Senator McCarthy surprised the nation when he almost defeated a Johnson write-in campaign with 42% of the vote. Kennedy, who privately thought McCarthy vain and lazy, now told reporters that he was actively reassessing his own position. He assured the new Secretary of Defense, Clark Clifford, that he would not challenge the president if Johnson would agree to appoint an independent commission to reconsider the war, with Kennedy and other doves among its members. By now, Mayor Daley, whose influence among Democrats extended far beyond Chicago, had quietly come to oppose the war. He nudged Johnson to accept a commission, insisting in a telephone call that it would not take any power away from the president, but just analyze and review the conflict. But to Johnson, accepting Kennedy's idea would mean putting his command of the war effort in receivership. Turning it down, he told Clark Clifford that a commission would appear to be a political deal. Thus, on March 16th, Kennedy went to the Senate caucus room and announced that he would run, not to oppose any man, but to propose new policies. His competitive juices flowing, Johnson told Clark Clifford, "What we've got to do is get out of the posture of just being the war candidate that McCarthy and Bobby have put us in. We're the true peace candidate. We're not the Chamberlain peace. We're the Churchill peace." Clifford, who himself by now had profound doubts about the war, replied, "We would frighten the people if we just said we are going to win. They would think, well, hell, it just means we're going to keep pouring men until we win militarily." But Johnson scoffed, "We're not going to get these doves." On March 22nd, the president warned Senator Russell, "Bobby is storming these states and those governors to switch the bosses all over the country in a pretty ruthless blitz operation. They're going to beat hell out of us in Wisconsin." Recalling the state's isolationist tradition, he went on to say, "You know the La Follettes, don't you? Well, it's still there, pretty deep, they tell me. They're against any war." Reading from Michael Beschloss's essay on Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War, in his essay in his book, Presidents of War, will be continued. This is Wallace Klunkhamst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.